Hey, how you doing? In this episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks, Samsung's new Galaxies, NVIDIA's new GeForces, Huawei's MateBook, and much more next. It's episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks. How you doing? It's just me on a little bit of wiki skipping or something. I don't know. I was playing DJ there for a minute. I'm Dave Altavilla. Welcome back to the show we call 2.5 Geeks. Good to have you with us here. Happy Friday, everybody. We typically try and go on Wednesdays, but we're Friday and fabulous today, I hope. Marco, are you Friday fabulous today?
I'm as close to Friday fabulous as I will ever get.
There, wow, that's actually probably pretty good then, generally speaking. yeah. So and we're typically 2.5 geeks. We're missing our third. We're going to get back to Wednesdays, but we've been doing a lot of traveling lately, traveling men. And so we've had to go Fridays, and that leaves us one short. But how's it going, buddy? Are you dug out of the pile of hardware that you are amassing or have amassed over the past few weeks?
Oh God, no. We did get to launch GeForce GTX 1660 this morning. That basically arrived last week and sort of threw my schedule off. I have some really cool hardware that I'm finished testing, but I have to lay out and write the articles. Maybe there's a Quadro and a Titan in that mix. Just got a big stack of SSDs from Samsung to test. So there's lots of stuff happening.
All right. Nice. All kinds of stuff. And you've got some pretty retro sounding alarm bells going on in the background there, buddy.
I told my wife to move the phone away from my office door and she did not listen.
Well, I tell you, that's pretty retro. I mean, I don't know. It sounded like either Coleco or maybe I was listening to some sort of Donkey Kong music or I don't know what, but that was pretty snappy sounding.
It's actually Beethoven's Fior Elise, but with the caller ID, with the digital voice that calls out the caller ID, it kind of throws it off.
Nice. Oh, yeah, I would say it throws it off. Beethoven's turning over in his grave. Hey, so cool. Well, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on, both in the PC component arena and the mobile arena. Big launches this week. That will be near and dear to the hearts of tech enthusiasts everywhere. Whether you like it, whether you like your supercomputers in your pocket or on your desktop. So let's dive in and we'll mix it up with, offerings from both camps, the mobile computing and the desktop enthusiast computing world. And let's start with, what's probably top of mind for many folks in the PC gaming space, the NVIDIA GeForce GTX with a GTX 1660 Ti. There's EVGA's card, and it's the new Turing architecture, well under $300. Sounds like a bargain, is it, Marco?
Bargain might be a stretch, but it is a good value in its price segment. So this is Turing. The GeForce GTX 1660 Ti is a Turing-based GPU, but it is not like the GeForce RTX series. You know, just the name alone probably gives you a hint that this isn't quite like the others. The difference with the GPU on the 1660 Ti is that it lacks the Tensor and RT cores, so no DLSS, no hardware accelerated ray tracing support. But what it gets are all, you know, the new shader functionality, the ability to do concurrent floating point and integer math, the better encoding engine, the new cache structure. And ultimately, you know, you end up with more efficient, faster shaders than Pascal. The configuration also, you know, let me just do a quick rundown versus, say, the 1060. So 1660 Ti versus 1060. The 1660's got 1536 CUDA cores versus 1280 in the 1060. They both have 6 gigs of RAM, but it's running at 12 gigabits per second on the 1660. They're also both connected over 192-bit interface, but you end up with much more bandwidth on the 1660 Ti. They have a similar number of ROPs. So on older titles that are just, you know, fill rate limited, it's not going to perform all that much different than a 1060, but more texture units. So, you know, it's basically a new balance here to the GPU structure, and it ends up in our testing performing about on par with a 1070 in most of the games. There's a couple instances where the 1070 is faster, and it crushes the 1060 across the board. There's a couple of spots where it's close, but it literally beats the 1060 across the board at both 1080p and 1440p, and the card's only 279. So if you look at the current landscape, the 1070 is way more expensive than 279. The prices are all over the map because of, you know, availability is sort of shrinking. Cards like the Vega 56, you know, we got a note yesterday that you can find them for 279. I'll be damned if any actual listings showed it at that price. There were about $400 everywhere. And, you know, like the Radeon RX 590 is like a $250, $260 card for the higher end ones. And it generally outperforms that across the board. The 590 scored a couple of victories in a few titles, but generally where the 1660 is faster, it's much faster. So yeah, it doesn't, the 1660 Ti doesn't change the game, but it is a, you know, a good value, good power. It would barely more power than a 1060, although it beat it in the benchmarks. And it is really overclockable. I hit 2.1 gigahertz with minimal tweaking, though you are limited to what you can do. I couldn't raise the power target or voltage that's artificially limited on these cards. But still, it overclocked to 2.1 gigahertz anyway.
Huh. So, and actually, let's. I want to skip back real quick on that spec list. I detected maybe we had a typo on our chart. I'm not sure.
Okay.
16 nanometer or 12 nanometer GPU?
It looks like a typo. It's a 12 nanometer. It's a 12 nanometer FinFET. I will go fix that while we're talking.
No, the only reason why I asked that is because it has more CUDA cores, you know, and Turing CUDA cores, obviously, optimized Turing architecture, more CUDA cores, higher memory bandwidth, and, you know, a couple billion more transistors than a 1060. But I think you also noted that it uses only a little bit more power than a 1060 and way less power than a 1070 from the previous gen, right?
It's not way less power than a 1070, but yes, it's fair to say it's less power than 1070. So if you jump, let me just jump to that graph to refresh my memory. Yeah, it was something like 20 more watts than a 1060. Yeah. But, you know, versus the 1070, you know, we're talking peak power consumption 252 versus 264 on the 1070. So its performance is about on par, maybe a little better, but at similar or lower power. So it basically hints at Turing's better power efficiency versus Pascal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but not enabled with RT cores, not enabled with DLSS technology, DLSS, the deep learning super sampling technology that AA or really machine learning image processing, if you will. It doesn't really do AA, sort of does. It samples versus AA samples. But not enabled in this GPU. Great price point, or certainly a much more palatable price point for the mainstream. Certainly fills a nice gap, I guess, in the price point and performance spectrum, you know, where it's, you know, about on par with the 1070. But what's your gut feel for the average gamer where you don't get those forward-looking, you know, engines, forward-looking architecture rendering, you know, effects available in this GPU?
Well, I mean, it is what it is. If you want RTX today, you got to spend minimum about $60 to $70 more. So about, you know, 20% more for a RTX 2060. If you can spare that $50-$60, I say absolutely go for it. It's nice to have the feature support. And, you know, the 2060 did offer significantly better performance across the board as well. The 2060 is, you know, about on par with the 1080 for those of you with older cards. Now, if you're a couple generations back, if you're on a, you know, a 960 class card, or, you know, Radeon RX 470 class card, you know, a generation or two back, for under $300, you can get a big boost in performance for 1080p gaming, assuming you don't have a, you know, if you have a graphics card like that, you probably don't have a 4K monitor. So for 1440p and 1080, if you have a couple generations old card and you looking for a GPU under $300, it's probably the GPU to get. We got to see how this affects pricing. I have a feeling we're going to see some price rejiggering going on. I saw a special on one RX 590 for $199, which is kind of out of character. You know, we heard about a price reduction on the Vega 56. It didn't really materialize online, but if that happens, the Vega 56 is faster overall. So we got to see how it shakes out. If you're buying a car today or for, you know, the next few weeks, and you have $280 to spend roughly, it's the car to get, basically.
Yeah. I was noticing you've added some additional numbers in with Vega 56 with RX 590. Good job there, by the way, to get those. I think those are important price points and, you know, competitive offerings from AMD. It looks like it is notably faster than a 590 in almost.
Yeah, there's a couple of spots where the 590 pulls ahead.
Okay. Yeah. I was just looking at like our Tomb Raider numbers. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Shadow of War, the Radeon RX 590 pulls ahead by a couple of frames. And that's even when you are scaled up to 1440p. Same thing at 1080. Interesting. I mean, it's definitely a cool card. What's a RX 590 go for these days? I'd have to look that up too.
Find most of them are about $259, but like I said, I did see one on sale for $199. So there's probably going to be some movement there. We got to see how it all shakes out over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. And as you said, RX Vega 56, we haven't been able to find for, you know, a competitive price point in that range. Although we're hearing rumblings that supposedly that's coming.
Right. So we got a note yesterday, basically saying, hey, you know, for $279, the Vega 56 does XYZ. And it had a link to a Newegg listing for an MSI Vega 56 at $279, but it was unavailable. And if you just went to Newegg's site and searched for MSI Vega 56, that particular listing never came up. And if you sort by lowest price, the lowest price of Vega 56 was $399, and it was even higher on Amazon. Now, it's been a few hours since we looked. That might have changed in the last few hours. I don't think so. But yeah, so if the Vega 56 does ultimately shoot down to the same, you know, $279-ish price point, it's a louder card that consumes more power, but it's a faster card overall. So there's, you know, we'll see how things shake out in the next few weeks.
Yeah. GeForce GTX 1660 Ti. Yeah, you know, that's what strikes me about this card specifically is its efficiency. It seems low powered. You got a single, well, the stock spec, if you will, single six pin PCI Express power connector. In the EVGA card you tested, it was 8-pin. Oh, it was 8-pin?
Yeah. It was 8-pin on the EVGA card. It doesn't really need it because 120-watt TDP. So between the slot and a 6-pin should be plenty, but I think the partners just want to build in some headroom. You know, if you look at my overclocking data, overclocked to 2.1 gigahertz without a voltage tweak, the thing was only running at 65 degrees. So, you know, if one of NVIDIA's partners wanted to go nuts, they can probably turn the power target up 20% on this thing, crank the voltage, and you'd get some insane clocks out of this chip, I have a feeling.
Yeah, really. So it was only pushing 65C when it went 65 overclocked.
65C under load at 2.1 gigahertz overclocked, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was barely breaking a sweat, man.
Yeah, the chip could have done a lot more if it wasn't artificially limited on that power target. Well, I mean, maybe it's not artificial, but if the board, you know, if the power circuitry can't support much more, it is what it is. But to not have the slider at all just seemed funky.
Right. I wonder if this is a performance enthusiast slash, you know, bang for your buck, extraordinaire sort of experiment, you know, sleeper card where folks can, like you say, really crank on this thing and get, you know, some serious extra bang for your buck out of it. Could be interesting to see how that works.
Entirely possible. We'll see. I have a feeling some of the partner, like there, most of the boards, like the EVGA card we looked at, most of the partner board. So that's another distinction here. There is no Founders Edition. All of the 1660s are coming from NVIDIA's partners. And like 90% of them are small form factor boards like the EVGA card we looked at. There were a couple of full-size boards with dual fans. Maybe those have beefier power circuitry and those partners will enable the ability to manipulate the power target, but I'm not sure. Excuse me.
Yeah. You know, it's a tough one. I mean, for me, I would, you know, I would spend a few extra bucks and get those RT cores and get the, you know, the tensor cores as well for, you know, future machine learning capabilities, with respect to game rendering, and image processing, you know, whether it be DLSS or something else that NVIDIA could potentially deploy with its tensor cores in the architecture. But, not everybody has those dollars to spare, and the under $300 price point is probably where the majority of discrete graphics cards are sold these days. Would you say that's a fair estimation? $300 or less?
Yeah, from, you know, that $179 to $279 price point is definitely where the bulk of the market is. So for those consumers, they now have a nice power efficient tweakable option, that's, you know, faster than anything else at that price today.
And generally available. I mean, we saw these things instantly on Amazon.
Yeah.
I will, I'll have to drop a link in. Let me see if I can grab that. But I saw EVGAs, thankfully, right in there. Let me look at this right now. GTX 1660 Ti. Yeah, there it is. Well, yeah, there it is. 279, yep. Right on the nose. Mm-hmm. And I will drop a link in the chat or in the description below, maybe here for the video, just so everybody can check that out. If you want to get one, they're in stock. They're in stock on Amazon and ready now. So I wonder what obviously the motivation, and we won't chew too much more on this topic, but I wonder what, you know, obviously the motivation was to get to a price point with Turing, with their current gen GPU architecture, to, you know, address a price point and a segment of the market that, you know, is mainstream, you know, purchasing graphics cards in volume, in a certain volume point that's different than, you know, a $400 or $500 or $600, or in the case of, a 2080 Ti, a lot more than that. But do you think it's also perhaps yield loss mitigation? So in other words, you know, there's some GPUs. We know it's a different GPU. It's TU106, right? And versus
TU116.
Is 116. And 106 is the other, the full 20 series.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a different GPU, but is it just a cut? You know, where, you know, maybe the tensor cores and or one, you know, one of those complexes didn't make the cut in, you know, in the fab, and then NVIDIA said, let's just bond this thing out differently. We're going to shut off our RT cores. We're going to shut off tensor cores because it didn't make one of those RTX specs in those special functions. So, but we can still capitalize and sell some of these GPUs. What do you think? Is that a possibility here?
I'm not sure. I don't think so, because of, you know, the way, if you look at the die map, like I don't have an actual die shot, but if you look at the die map, it doesn't look like they'd be able to do that, you know, and maintain a functional GPU with the way the memory controllers are situated around the edge and all that kind of good stuff. It's possible. It's entirely possible. It would, you know, make sense financially if you could do that. But I think it's just a newer, smaller GPU. Like when you're looking at a die size, so 284 square millimeters for this, 445 square millimeters for RTX 2060.
Yeah.
You know, those additional CUDA cores and Tensor RT cores add a lot of die area. It's 161 square millimeter difference. You know, a whole GeForce GTX 1060 at 16 nanometer is 200 square millimeters. So it's like, it's literally, you know, a whole GPU savings worth of die area. So.
Yeah. No, that's a good point too. So you think it, there's a 1660 mask set, if you will, and those wafers are partitioned out efficiently for that GPU. That's likely the case, is what you think.
I think so.
We're speculating.
I think so.
Because, you know, and we're speculating here, and we have to speculate because I don't know many, if any, semiconductor company that will talk about yield of its chips, because that's just a secret, you know, sauce variable that is not discussed, right? It's just not ever.
It's not openly. And then there was that crazy news out of TSMC recently about that was like $500 million worth of wafers that got screwed up, and NVIDIA was likely affected. So who knows?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you go. There's another one too there, right? Suddenly something else is born. OGOG says, what is EVGA even thinking with a three-slot cooler on a 120-watt TDP card? Good point.
Except, you know, I feel the same way. I'm not a huge fan of these triple slot coolers. I don't know. Like, you could see a Founders Edition, a dual slot card, not this particular one because there isn't one, but there's lots of dual slot cards. Maybe they're a little higher temps, but we're not talking out of the ballpark here. And to sacrifice the slots doesn't make a ton of sense to me. Now, the flip side is, you know, this isn't 15 years ago where enthusiasts tried to fill every slot and every drive bay in their systems. Most systems nowadays have one graphics card, maybe a PCIe SSD, maybe a sound card, and that's it.
Yeah.
Most. I'm not saying all, most. So if you're addressing most of the market, triple slot card is not a big deal. But I feel the same way. Like, I'm not huge on wasting all of that slot real estate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So OGOG wants one of those thinner, more svelte versions that occupies no more than two slots. That's a fair request, I'm sure. Have you seen others out there? We've seen a lot of leaks on this. This thing was leaked to death, so we have seen other OEM cards. Let's see. What can we say?
Oh,
we
yeah, know Asus, there's a lot.
Yeah.
There's two slot cards. Just these, the little short boards, some of the companies went with they kept the PCB short, but thick on the cooler.
Yeah, yeah, good for perhaps smaller chassis form factors where motherboard length, maybe it's micro ATX or something like that, where you have a home, more of a home theater PC format that this would be a better fit for, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a mini ITX, a little tiny rig, and you know, and the slot extends out off the motherboard, and you're not really losing anything as long as the case can accommodate it. You know, you don't sacrifice any surface area. You get killer cooling, but yeah, you know, in a regular system.
So ultimately, yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, no, I hear you. So ultimately, you would give this a recommended or passing grade by NVIDIA, adding something to the mix here, being devil's advocate, versus some other solutions in the marketplace from AMD, you'd still say this is something to consider?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no question about it. So based on current pricing, it's arguably the strongest card at the price point, and it's cooler, quieter, more overclockable than competing cards at similar price points. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No question about it. Gotta love the simple elegance of a cool and quiet card with one PCI Express power connector. It's not going to beat the heck out of your power supply to light it up. It's not going to dim the lights in your house and offer some pretty solid performance. So 1440p and under. So would you say 1440p ultra settings and pretty much any game you throw at it, it can handle?
Not every game. It's smooth. You're not going to get that, 60 FPS plus at 1440p with every game. Perfectly capable 1440p card, though, yes. It's ideal for 1080p, but 1440p is not out of the realm.
You know, it's funny. We used to think 30 frames per second was playable, and now most gamers you talk to, 30 FPS is not playable. It's that 60 FPS bar. So yeah, interesting. How the dynamics change. We used to put up with crappy frame rates, didn't we?
Oh man, the things we put up with back in the day. Remember the first demo when we saw AA for the first time on what was it? The Voodoo 3. It was with Falcon 4.0 in a hotel room in New York, and we were watching the mountains look all jaggy, and then they hit the button and the jaggies disappeared, and we were like,
yeah, which is just crazy. You dated Falcon 4.0.
It was Falcon 4.0. Yeah. I still remember the demo. I still remember Burke and who was the big guy from 3D Effects.
Oh, I'm blanking now.
I forget his name.
He's speaking of Brian Burke of NVIDIA. What's that?
At NVIDIA now, and it was the big guy from 3D Effects. I forget it. It'll come to me later.
Yeah, yeah. If it comes to you, just blurt it out.
All right, I will.
And we'll reminisce some more because we've been in this business too long. We started this gig, hothardware.com, back in 1999 when the internet was just a fledgling little group of Heck, we were still on 14.4 modems, for Christ's sake.
I don't know if it was that far back, but yeah.
It wasn't that far back. All right. Well, let's move on. Let's move on to the land of mobile. And I'm scruffy and, a little bit road weary from visiting my friends at Samsung out in San Francisco, which is only a short 6-hour hop flight from the Boston area where I hail from. But yes, the Samsung Galaxy S10 family unleashed. We've got hands-on, we've got features, we've got specs, and we've even got some benchmarks, which you should check out at hothardware.com. I will drop some links into the chat right now. But let's talk about Samsung's new bauble. There it is, the Samsung Galaxy S10. There are three in the family currently. There's another one coming. That's the Galaxy S10 Plus there. It is a 6.4-inch AMOLED display, what they're calling a dynamic AMOLED display now. Super AMOLED is sort of a, not a thing of the past, I guess, but it is a new HDR 10 Plus certified AMOLED display that's in these phones now. So much wider, brighter color gamut, much better color fidelity in general. And there's also a blue light reduction technology as well, which doesn't affect the color reproduction accuracy, but limits, I think it's like 30% less offensive and harmful blue light that's emitted from these displays. And it's the Infinity O display. Now, I have one of them right here. I do. And I'm going to try and turn down the display brightness so I can show you without blowing out the screen. But there it is. There's the Infinity O display of the Galaxy S10. As you can see, let me see if I can get a little bit crisper. As you can see, super thin bezels, and I'm sorry about the reflection. That's a little better there. Super thin bezels all around. So this is a 6.4-inch Galaxy S10 Plus, and I can just tell you, it does not feel like a 6.4-inch phone. It is super efficient in the hand, and it is gorgeous. This is the back of it, as you can see, and this is what they call Prism White, which actually, as you can see, again, sorry about the webcam lack of fidelity here, but we're at 1080p, but it still doesn't do it justice. Prism White reflects sort of blue hues and different hues that are in the environment around you. It's really a cool color. It looks neat. It has this sort of metallic reflective quality about it that's white, pure white sometimes, and then picks up the colors in the environment around you. So it's a really cool color. And then of course the build quality on this thing is just sublime. It is impeccable. And I'm gushing a little bit, because what impresses me, I think, the most about Samsung devices over the years, the Galaxy S10 no exception, actually probably improves on things even more with that efficient display and those thin bezels. And you do have a very small cutout right here in the top right corner of the display where it does punch through. It's two front-facing cameras. It has two front-facing cameras, different wide aspect cameras. And what impresses me, though, over the years with Samsung devices is just the build quality is just so good. It's just really smooth. It has certainly curved glass, on the front and the back, and it cradles well in the hand. It's not slippery, because they've figured out a way to make these edges grippable with, high polished machined aluminum around the edges. So that's pretty solid. It's not a slippery slick device per se. You can hold on to it pretty well, and it's just super well made. On bottom, USB-C headphone jack, and the single down firing speaker, which actually puts out some pretty good sound. I wish we had some stereo speaker capability, but it puts out some pretty good volume. Sounds great. What do you think about the design, Marco? Are you a fan of the Galaxy series? Just mechanically speaking, and then we'll get into specs and other things.
Yeah, absolutely. Gorgeous smartphones. I haven't experienced it firsthand. The cutout for the cameras, I guess technically you get more real estate than a notch. It just seems weird to have a thing floating up there in the display. Then again, if you ask general consumers, I don't think they care. It's just me being a nerdy geek and being critical of the device. But in terms of the specs and what Samsung has done with that phone, in terms of the camera, the build, just the overall look, you know, that fast Snapdragon 855 inside should be a kick-ass phone. You know, and you can even, there's a 1 terabyte model. Did I read that correctly?
Yeah, yeah, 1 terabyte of internal storage, and you can add additional external storage, a micro SD card, and get up to 1.5 terabytes total in the phone that it will support. Yeah,
that's awesome.
So, you know,
tooling around on it, how does it feel?
So it feels super fast. I mean, and one of the things that that Samsung touts with this, obviously, as well, is their One UI, their new One UI, which, frankly, let me see if I can just pull it up for you a little bit, and you can take a look at it here. I just pulled down the configuration, or the, excuse me, the advanced, or the settings roll down from the top, excuse me, and, you know, just the quick access settings here. As you can see, it's clean. You know, I'd have to poke around a little bit more and you know, get a good feel for living with it. I've only had it for a day. But it certainly feels fast. It's very responsive. That's one of the things I sort of, you know, worry about a little bit with Samsung, is the tendency to try and reinvent the Android wheel and put in little apps and features that aren't necessary, you know, that bloat the OS. And I'm not getting that sense in my first, you know, day with the phone and sort of, you know, just hanging out with it and playing with it a little bit and, you know, installing my apps and my account and just getting set up. It's pretty clean that way. Very fast, very responsive. This is an 8 gig of RAM, 128 gig storage variant of the Galaxy S10 Plus. And, yeah, you know, it's Snapdragon 855. We did some numbers on it, John. I don't know if you can bring that up. But if you look at the benchmark numbers, this, you know, and we have to, you know, put a caveat. This is the beginning of, let me see if I can drop this into the chat as well. Here are some benchmarks. Bang. John, if you can throw those up. So this is the one of the first Snapdragon 855 phones we've tested. So what's going to happen versus Snapdragon 845? It's going to be a much faster phone. You know, the claim from Qualcomm at the time was somewhere in the order of 20 to 30%, depending on whether you're talking CPU or GPU performance. The Snapdragon 855 is going to bring that much more incremental performance over 845, the previous generation, basically de facto Android platform processor across so many different brands, except for phones like Huawei or something like that. So yeah, 855 is a nice boost in performance. If you look at the benchmarks, CPU and GPU, I think if you look at, you know, standard CPU stuff like Geekbench, you've got 11,000, you know, multi-core performance, 11,200 or so Geekbench points versus previous generation, you know, some of the best, fastest phones we've seen out there in the 9,000 range. So a nice incremental boost there. Single core CPU performance is actually also pretty impressive as well. There was a nice gain from about 2,500 in the 845 to 3,500. So just single core IPC throughput from the processor now. That's the 3D Mark score there. So that gives you a sense of graphics. But CPU, you've got some nice gains there. And then on the graphics side, again, about a 30% jump. I'd have to do some quick math. But, you know, if you look at some of the higher end graphics benchmarks, I don't know if you can scroll down a little bit on that, John. Go to GFX Bench Manhattan, the bottom chart. Here you're looking at 102 frames per second versus 87 or 86, excuse me, in the previous gen. And if you do the math on that, you know, you're talking something like, you know, 18, 19% gain in performance from a graphics standpoint only. And so, you know, some nice gains there, certainly. What else can I tell you that's interesting about this phone? Well, to me, it's some of the new features that Samsung brings with the phone that really make it special. And they continue to innovate really well, I think, bringing out, you know, features that matter to consumers. On the back of the phone, you've got three cameras here. You've got a super wide aspect angle lens. You've got a wide aspect, you know, a wider aspect angle lens, and then a standard shot or telephoto lens. What you get there is a much greater capability to capture a larger field of view. It's actually 123 degrees, which is roughly, I think it's 120 degrees, is what the human eye can perceive without, you know, counting your periphery. And so you've got that. And then what's cool about it is it also switches to whichever camera is best for the shot you're composing, whether by manually selecting it, in a drop menu, or just doing pinch and zoom. It'll automatically switch between any one of those three cameras, depending on how you're framing the shot, how much you're zooming in or not, and how much you're intending to capture. So that's a cool feature. I think the display, I'm really interested in putting the display to the test a little bit more. I think the display is just killer. This thing is visible all the time, in daylight, even on moderate, brightness settings. So you're not killing your battery, really visible display. And it looks great. I think honestly, over the years, Samsung Super AMOLED displays have been, my personal preference in phones. I haven't found an OLED display that competes at quite as well as some of Samsung Super AMOLEDs. This takes it up a notch, I believe, and it's looking really good. I want to A/B it versus like the Galaxy Note 9 and see how that matches up. But really impressive display. There's lots of other features in this phone, though. Marco, help me out. What else are you intrigued by with? And we're stepping through the review process. We're not going to give you a final verdict yet, but it's impressive at first blush for sure.
Yeah. So that a few weeks back, the news hit about Samsung developing that 1 terabyte, a UFS storage inside. I have a feeling that's going to make the phone feel nice and snappy because it's, low latency and faster than a typical storage in a phone. That, with that new SoC, all that memory, it's basically, a huge upgrade across the board. And, I've been on a Note 8 now, I guess, for about a year, maybe a year and a half, maybe not quite that long. And my earlier Samsung phones, I'm just going back to what you were saying about the software and about, Samsung's TouchWiz sort of getting in the way. Older phones, I did have some issues. This Note 8 has been treating me perfectly, though. So if they've refined it further and it doesn't quite get in the way, it's probably going to be a non-issue. And they have to do some customization just to support all of the different features in the phone. So yeah, I'm looking forward to checking out the S10. I think that's my next phone. Not sure.
Interesting. Yeah, honestly, my daily driver is a OnePlus 6, and I absolutely love the phone. I think it's a fantastic value for consumers. It's like $579 for an 8 gig RAM, 128 gig storage variant. Has a great OLED display, 6.28 inch. Has a notch, but it's a smaller notch. And by the way, let me see if I can pull this up for you. Yeah, so you can see what the notch looks like. There's the notch. It's not crazy. I actually like it. I think it's efficient. It's, I am right-handed, and perhaps as a result, I like my tiny little, oblong notch over on the right, but it looks, mostly balanced to me. And you can see down the bottom here is your home back and, app tray, buttons that come on, the screen. They can be translucent at times too. So that they don't just, they don't take up bezel like that. So they're on the home screen. You can see them, and they're just, mapped over the home screen. But I think it's set up really nice. And you're right. What OGOG in the chat says, TouchWiz is garbage and laggy. I am not getting laggy at all from this phone anywhere. However, I can relate to the previous generation, certainly the TouchWiz era. There was certainly, it felt like bloat and then a little bit of Android bit rot. No question about that. I think that's a thing of the past now with Samsung phones. As you noted, I think somewhere around the 8 series, things started getting significantly better. I am interested to find out how this new One UI feels and operates just in general seems pretty good so far. I want to do things like simple stuff, like I fire up a text message and do speech to text. How does it react? How easy it is it to use? How accurate is it? I remember having issues with previous generation Samsung phones where the interface for, I do a lot of that, you know, just talking to the phone versus texting because I'm a klutz with my thumbs. But I want to see simple stuff like that in the day-to-day, you know, living on the device, how it reacts, because that's important. That's a huge part of the user experience. And if you can live with how these manufacturers sort of make Android their own, by adding, you know, differentiation in spots that they think are important. It's a useful thing. Great. Or if it improves, great. But if it's just a reinvention of the wheel and it's bloaty and gets in the way, which has happened depending on the manufacturer you speak of. Yeah. It's a pain in the butt. So, I'm impressed so far. I'm really looking forward to, you know, getting into it. The camera, I think, is going to kick butt. I'm expecting things to do really well, camera wise, but I want to give it some more time. So just to go through the series one more time, 6.4-inch Galaxy S10 Plus is what I have here. How you tell the difference between it and its lower end siblings is the double camera punch out on the front, the two front facing cameras for selfies. The Galaxy S10 standard is a 6.1-inch, also has two cameras in the front. The Galaxy S10e, you can identify, it's a smaller 5.8-inch display. Certainly the device looks smaller, has a single front facing camera. So that's the, you know, if you're looking at them side by side, they actually all can kind of blur because the design signature is so similar. And then there's one that's not available quite yet, but that Samsung showcased, gave us a little bit of hands-on time with, and then quickly took it away. That's the Galaxy S10 5G. And that is a 6.7-inch Android flagship from Samsung. It will be available, I believe it's the April timeframe. And the difference there is you now have Qualcomm's 5G modem, Snapdragon X50, and you have a larger 6.7-inch dynamic AMOLED display and a larger 4,500 milliamp hour battery. So, by the way, Galaxy S10 Plus, 4,100 milliamp hour battery. I think it's 34 in the S10 standard and 31 in the S10e. And so the batteries are pretty bodacious as well. And I'm expecting battery life in this guy especially, which I think is where a lot of the volume, I think the S10 and the S10 Plus, they're going to do a lot of the volume there. Battery life should be really good. So we'll see. What are you thinking? You're thinking you may give this a shot at your daily driver.
Yeah. I think what I would do is an S10 Plus, an 8 gig version, but with a smaller amount of internal storage, and then just throw a big micro SD card in there for, you know, they're super cheap. Instead of dropping $15,000, you know, $1,500 on a phone, I'd go for the smaller storage option and just expand it with micro SD. You can get like 256 gigs for $40, you know.
Yeah, what do we know for pricing on this? We've got I'd have to look that up. Hang on one sec. I'm running out of, oh, there it is right there. So priced from $749 for the S10e, $899 for the S10, and $1,000 for the S10 Plus. They ain't cheap. They're cheaper than Apple.
Do we know the specs on the $1,000 S10e? Is it 8 gig 128?
No,
S10 Plus. I'm sorry, S10 Plus. Is it 8 gig 128 gigs of storage? That's the $999.
The $999 config, I believe, is the 8 gig 128 gig of storage. I'd want to confirm that. That's an important distinction, Marco, because there is a 12 gig 1 terabyte, and that's, I don't know, that's got to be more.
That ain't going to be $999.
No, yeah. Well, not if, yeah. Let me see. I'll hop on Samsung's pre-order page now. We got to really see this. Okay, so let's go to the, interesting. Okay, there's the plus, $999. 128 gig. Let's go to the 512 gig. Yeah, it's a little confusing right now. I will say that. I'd have to see it. This is interesting. We will come back to you folks on that. I believe it is starting though. I think that's the 8 gig, 128 gig variant, 8 gig of RAM, 128 gig of storage variant. That's $999.
Yeah,
I think that's a starting price. So still impressive stuff from Samsung. They are still, if you look at it from a, specs, relative comparison versus Apple's iPhone XS, still less expensive, but still pricey. I mean, $1,000 phones these days, it's kind of crazy, but that's the deal. It's seems like the watermark for the high-end flagships. Let's move on to another flagship, and we'll start wrapping up the phone segment and get back to notebooks before we close. Samsung also announced the Galaxy Fold. The Samsung Galaxy Fold flexes 6 cameras and 2 batteries and over 7 inches of screen real estate when it is expanded into tablet mode. And there it is right there. So you've got 2 4 and change inch displays that are, well, it's a one contiguous display, really. Flexible OLED display that has a mechanical hinge behind it that is fascinating to see it on stage. It was live on stage, as you can see. I don't know if you can scroll down, John, back on that post. Let me drop it into the chat just in case you need that. Yeah, there you go, right there. Thank you, John. They were demoing on stage. So what you're seeing there is a camera shot of a guy with the Galaxy Fold in his hand. And it's, currently in a 4.2 inch, I believe, folded form. And then, bang, it expands to 7.3 inch total. And as you can see, they've got multi-app switching. So 3 simultaneous apps are going on there. They've got YouTube going. They've got a chat going. And then they're browsing the web. So you can see the use cases and the sort of advanced capabilities of this with a big device like this. Now you're holding a 7-inch tablet when it's in that mode, essentially. And then they also have this thing called app continuity. So if you're looking at the fold in a handset mode and you're, I'm staring at something on the display and then I want to open it up and make it bigger. And they showed a case where they had Google Maps open on the 4-inch format. And then they opened it up to 7 inches and Google Maps just popped in, exactly where they had left off in the phone format, but in a much larger spread. They could see more of the real estate. They could pinch and zoom around. So they kept that app, that was basically showing on one back, display of the phone when they opened it up inside to the fold and opened up the fold. They kept that app continuous and contiguous across the display. And there wasn't a hiccup. It didn't have to you would think it might refresh or reset the screen, but it didn't. It just popped right in. So it was a live demo. Everything worked. I'll take a step back and say that one of the things we forgot about to talk about with the Galaxy series as well that they showed with the Fold were these little fellas. These are the Galaxy Buds, wireless charging, back again in the Galaxy S10 series and in the Fold. And wireless charge and share. So you just drop these things right on top of the phone, and I don't have it enabled now, but that wireless charging, you can charge your buds right on just sitting on top of your phone. So maybe you're heading to the gym, you get your phone down in the car seat, you drop your buds on top of the phone, and it's charging on your way to the gym. Kind of cool. I gave these a listen. They're not quite Bose quality, but they're pretty darn good for bundled buds. So let's get back to the Fold. I shifted gears on you there. That was an important feature. That charge and share, I thought, was an important feature. By the way, enabled by IDT's charging ICs, company I used to work for. Good folks at IDT, Integrated Device Technologies. Anyways, what do you think of the Fold, Marco? Big honking beast of a phone that turns into a tablet. Is it all that, or is it a little too much of a Franken device?
And it looks like a Franken device to me. Did you guys get to, did people who attended Unpacked get to actually play with it after the fact or no?
Nope. They had it hidden away. At least I you know, and we're in pretty tight analyst and press media circles. I did not get access to it, and I didn't see anybody else get access to it either. I can tell you it was running on stage. They were doing Google Maps. They fired up YouTube on it, fired up a web browser on it. I mean, they showed the OS on it. Everything was running.
Yeah, I mean, I have no doubt that having multiple screens works in Android. There's been multi-screen phones before, so this that part I get. What I'm not, I guess I need to understand better how the folding screen is going to hold up. How many folds do you actually get out of it? It looked kind of bulky when it was folded up. And I'm going to assume it's also not that it's a delicate device. They're going to build it for mobility, but it has a lot of glass and a lot of moving parts and lots of stuff to go wrong there with a fat phone in your pocket like that. So I guess if your use case is, you know, somewhere where that bigger screen will work for you, great. Otherwise, $2,000 for that weird form factor is not for me.
you call it weird, and I guess I think that's probably not quite fair, only because it's a form factor or a really a device implementation that we haven't seen before. Flexible OLED displays haven't been available. Samsung is sort of blazing a path here. They are blazing a trail here with this new technology and taking a first shot, a first stab at a flexible OLED enabled device. So it looks a little foreign. I think that's maybe a better word, foreign, right? Weird too. Depends on your choice of tomato, tomato, right? But it's fascinating that I think that they took this, plunge and put a product out there and said they were going to sell it. And here's the price point and here's the features and here's what it does. And we've got some software behind it. It was funny. I remember at one point Apple coming out said, we had the courage to remove the headphone jack, and everybody scoffed at that. Samsung isn't claiming courage. They haven't claimed courage to me on the Fold, but I think this is an example of design courage, right? That's what I like about it. They're actually stepping out with something completely innovative and different. Whether or not it's a success depends on how it rolls out in its final retail form to the consumer. Yeah, it's pricey as heck. I don't think this is a niche product. It's not a mainstream. To me, it's a niche product that's not mainstream for the consumer. I think it has perhaps some really good, maybe not so niche, obviously, in the enterprise. Healthcare, I could see this. Because you see doctors walking in every time you go to a doctor's office now, right, or in the hospital, everybody's documenting everything digitally. And there's more pen input. You know, my doc, when I go see him for a physical, he's got his pen and he's banging away on a Panasonic Toughbook, actually, with a pen. And, I could see this being a really, useful device in that use case. Pop it in your pocket, run to your next meeting or your next office visit. Open it up, bang, you've got that display to look at your eye chart spreadsheet of whatever, annotate. That's one of the things that I did think was a shortcoming. I asked them specifically in a meeting if it supported the S Pen. It does not. There is no pen input, at least from what I'm told. That may change down the road because the product isn't released yet. So I had an exec tell me that, though, Samsung exec, no pen support. Which I found odd. It's almost like you should have that. What I did hear, which they were very, close to the vest about, they didn't give me any information, was that there's all kinds of software support to be announced coming for this platform, that Samsung's going to really enable it with some powerful stuff. I didn't get what kind of stuff, but that's what I heard. So from that perspective, I think it's interesting, but yeah, $1,980, you're not going to go jump out and get one of those right away. Right, Marco?
not me. No. So, and I agree that Samsung should get credit, for basically launching the first foldable OLED device that, you know, if it goes on sale when they're saying, you know, they'll be the first with a product like that, that you can buy, that, you know, that's a big deal. Their screen manufacturing division is top notch. And for them to pull that off, no small feat. Stepping back as a consumer, I know we have to kind of wrap this up. Just having foldable technology doesn't really mean anything. You need to enhance the form factor, and it has to be a better product. You know, it has to basically enhance the experience to make that fold worth it. I'm not sure this particular model is it, but they do need to lay the groundwork for future devices that may have slimmer, sleeker form factors and similar technology. And, you know, you have to start somewhere, and that, you know, it's a bold first move by Samsung.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll move on to the next segment. We'll close out quick on it, too. We only got a couple minutes left. But yeah, Raymond Jeffries mentions in the chat, what kind of case you're going to have. Samsung has to come up with, you know, some accessories with this bad boy, because it is unique, for sure. Yeah. I don't know how you get a case on that puppy, and a screen protector for that matter. But it'll be interesting to see how it comes out. The Galaxy Fold in April. Keep your eye out for it. We'll definitely try and get a review on it at Hot Hardware. And stay tuned to Hot Hardware for our review of the Galaxy S10 Plus that I have in my possession now and will be beating on post haste. All right, let's shift gears real quick and close up with Huawei's MateBook 13. We did a review of that, a high performance ultrabook with caveats. Marco, this has got 8th gen quad core Intel platform on board, 13 inch IPS touch display. Nice 2160 by 1440 resolution, by the way, 3x2 format. NVIDIA, the discrete NVIDIA GeForce MX150 and 512 gigs of RAM, or excuse me, 512 gigs of NVMe storage, 8 gigs of RAM. What do you think about this? Pretty cool looking device. Love the thin bezels on the display.
Yeah, I'm gonna turbo this because we're running out of time. But it's exactly as you described it. It is a beautiful, slim, sleek ultrabook with some issues that you'd have to contend with. So inside this guy is a powerful Core i7 8565U true quad core processor in this guy. Plus, now here's something interesting for such a small 13-inch device, discrete NVIDIA GeForce MX150 graphics. So not a super high-end gaming laptop, but certainly enough horsepower and compatibility to run today's games, and definitely more performance than integrated Intel graphics. You have stereo speakers with Atmos support, but they're down-firing. You do have a fast Samsung NVMe SSD in there as well. But as you mentioned, you know, 8 gigs of RAM, that's, I'd call that the minimum today. It would be nice to have more memory in the device. The downfiring speakers, they sounded okay, but weren't great. And ultimately, you end up with a nice high-performance device with that mix of hardware. And as you can see in that picture, I think the form factor is beautiful. It's a very slim, sleek, lightweight, 2.86 pounds. So not super light, but certainly portable. But there's only a 41.7 watt hour battery, and if you look at the numbers, you know, having that discrete GPU and a super fast processor with a relatively small battery versus other 13 inch ultrabooks, not conducive to long battery life. So down at the lower third, towards the bottom in our battery life tests. Now, if you don't care, still going to get hours on the road. You're not going to get multi day out of this guy. If you're near an outlet but you like that form factor, beautiful device. If that battery life's a deal breaker, something to consider.
Yeah, you know, once you get under 3 pounds, I mean, my gosh, 2.8 pounds is pretty darn light. I would have opted for a larger battery. And these days in a 13-inch ultrabook form factor, you're seeing batteries approach 60 watt hour. Usually they're somewhere in the mid to high 50 watt hour range. This is a 41 watt hour battery. And I think that's where, unfortunately, Huawei missed the boat. Probably the biggest, I guess, you know, design check mark that they missed, if you will. But you know, that being said, if you take, you know, look at what we did for a battery test where we loop HD video continuously until the machine powers down at a certain threshold, minimum critical battery threshold, we still ended up with 5.5 hours of battery life doing constant, always on, with quick pauses in between each video loop, HD video, you know, playback. So not bad, but yeah, relative to its peers in the 13 inch category in the bottom half of the group. So that's the caveat, as well as that 8 gig of RAM put up, I imagine, although I'd have to confirm that is soldered to the motherboard. So you're not upgrading it either, right? So interesting. But yeah, that GeForce MX150, I mean, that adds a nice little kicker that a lot of, you know, sub 3 pound machines don't have.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you were to compare it to, you know, the bulk of Ultrabooks that just have integrated Intel graphics, for example, you know, you're talking more than double the performance for gaming. For example, just Grid Autosport at 1080p. The MateBook can do, you know, an average frame rate over 70 frames per second, whereas something like a, you know, a Dell XPS 13 or Acer Swift, it's in the 26 frames per second range. So not a super high-end gaming device. But if you want an Ultrabook that can game, this is it. You know, it has it.
Yeah, yeah. And there are a few, and there are a few out there that have discrete GPUs, but they usually get into higher, you know, bigger form factors like Dell's XPS 15 or something like that. And some of the larger Lenovo formats have discrete GPUs as well. So, yeah, interesting machine. Beautiful display setup. Love that thin bezel and that machined aluminum. And of course, you always have to remember to, you know, the little caveat of the government's warning about using Huawei devices and the privacy and security concerns. I don't know. We just say it because we feel like the consumers should know if they haven't already, which they probably do.
Yeah, I mean, right? It's the elephant in the room. I think the concerns are more with telecom equipment and having a Chinese company with hardware devices that are integral to your telecom infrastructure. But there's been lots of allegations thrown at Huawei. I know, like, there's been no specific single allegation on a device mentioned. And I don't think the community's found anything yet that I'm aware of. But, you know, it's something you do have to consider.
Yeah, yeah. So there you go. Check out all these reviews at Hot Hardware. We will be tossing a link list in the comments below. Check out our Galaxy S10 review when it's up in the days ahead. And it'll probably take me about a week to turn that out, to really get it right, to live with it. But right now we've got benchmarks up. We've got some really great hands-on, including a video demo with one of the executive product marketing directors at Samsung that takes you through the device as well. So good stuff. Check that out. Check out Marco's 1660 Ti review for all the benchmark details there as well. And you can find us on the web at hothardware.com, twitter.com/hothardware, youtube.com/hothardarevids or Hot Hardware. Thumbs up, subscribe to the channel so you can get notified. Hit the reminder bell so that we can see you here on the YouTubes. Right, Marco?
Yes, sirree.
And with that, we will bid you adieu. Happy Friday. Have a great weekend, everybody. And thanks for stopping by.